You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Paint from your heart and don't give a rip about what anyone says.
We just try to roll with what the Spirit's doing. The Lord is there and working.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, dance music and Christianity mixed together in Gospel Go-Go.
We're different in the fact that we're praising God, as well to show that Christian people are not tied in the behind and we can have fun in the Lord.
And a painter tells what it's like for him making spiritual art in a skeptical world.
The fact that it's meant religious imagery, that makes the secular art world uncomfortable. If it were ironic, it would be easier, because then no one has to own it.
We are talking today about entertainment made by evangelical Christians. My guest is the writer and Columbia University professor Randall Balmer.
The genius of evangelicalism throughout American history has been the innovative ways in which they are willing to package the gospel.
That and lots more ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Last spring, after Texaco canceled its sponsorship of the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts, and then Chrysler canceled its annual awards program for designers, I started wondering if there was some contagion of art indifference among big corporations. But this fall, during just the last few weeks, I've come across three very different instances of businesses supporting art, not as traditional philanthropists giving money away to creative types, but by embracing art and artists as small parts of their businesses, because they've decided that's good for their corporate images. The first was the New York Museum show Glass and Glamour, Steuben's Modern Moment, 1930 to 1960. It's an exhibit of objects from the time when this fussy, traditional, old-line glass company went virtually avant-garde overnight. In the early 1930s, they started recruiting modernist designers like Walter Dorwin Teague to make bowls and vases and goblets that were radically simple and austere. Some of their pieces featured designs by artists like Matisse and Isamu Noguchi. It's a lovely show and a reminder of how corporate cultures and culture don't necessarily have to be at odds. What really heartened me about Steuben, though, is what I just learned from a reliable source, that their executives today are quietly exploring a return to that kind of collaboration and commissioning cutting-edge artists to create new glass pieces. And then there's the story about executives at Barnes & Noble who've just republished a literary novel that had been out of print for 30 years. The book is Stones of Summer, which one obsessed reader had made a film about. A film you may have discovered first here on Studio 360.
Sitting over the quarry, Travis Thomas shuffled the dirt through his hand.
I can't believe a guy can write a book this good and just disappear.
Barnes & Noble say they've sold 15,000 copies in less than a month. And then there's Nissan, the Japanese car company. They've just launched what may be the single strangest campaign by a major advertiser ever. You know the commercials that play before the trailers, before the movies in theaters these days? Well, Nissan bought some of those spots for its Altima model in theaters showing the new Matrix Revolutions movie. And then they hired live actors to portray poets and planted them in the audiences in certain theaters. During the ads on screen, these professional pseudo-poets each suddenly stand up and, without any warning or explanation, scream out their Nissan scripted lines of poetry, like this.
Who are you?
A chill, little garupa fritka!
Goodness for bad boys!
Courage when heads are held low!
A white hot meteor against the cloudy sky!
You!
the east side all tonight.
It's bizarre, and I guess I should take it as another sign of the decline and fall of Western civilization. But I've got to say, I love that a big corporation has the guts to do something this wacky and human and small scale. As I said, none of these experiments is pure patronage, like Texaco with Opera or Chrysler with design. These businesses are all trying to sell things, not give them away. But I find each one interesting and even a little exciting. These corporations are making real bets on the proposition that art is good and useful. In each case, some big deal decision maker has had to say yes to a real and even risky aesthetic choice, which is definitely not business as usual. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and it is now time for today's cover story, Evangelical Pop. Just the other night on MTV's Total Request Live, a rock band called POD showed up to play. POD stands for Payable on Death.
Here we are, straight from Southern California. Warriors, make some noise for Give It Up for POD!
POD has beat out Britney Spears and Madonna for requests on the MTV show. They have gone platinum with songs that Rolling Stone magazine describes as a, quote, highly aggressive fusion of metal, hardcore, and hip-hop. And POD's members are born-again Christians. Sonny, the singer in the band, calls the music his ministry.
See you sitting next to the window in the bedroom, she breaks down. Crying over something and staring into nothing, afraid now.
When I was a little kid, Christian entertainment was different. The only example I saw regularly was a claymation show called Davy and Goliath, with Davy the boy and Goliath his dog.
It says danger, Davy. Let's go back.
Why?
Danger.
Don't be an old scaredy cat.
Who's a cat? Who's scared?
The Evangelical Lutheran Church hired the same team that made Gumby to make It. The show went out, syndicated for free, to about 180 TV stations at the time, including mine in Omaha. The basic moral each week was that Davy could avoid getting in trouble if he'd only listened to his parents. And sometimes, as I recall, Jesus' name did come up. Today, entire cable networks devote themselves to Christian entertainment, and the message is more clearly a call to faith than ever before.
This is the Trinity Broadcasting Network, celebrating 30 years of God's miracles.
Like the channel I sometimes take a look at, the Trinity Broadcasting Network. The programs aren't just preachers preaching, but specially made sitcoms and game shows and rock concerts. Today we're looking at some of the entertainment made by evangelicals, art that is on a mission to express something of their God and often intended to win converts. My guest is Randall Balmer. He's a professor of religion at Barnard College at Columbia University, and he's the author of Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture in America. He's also written a memoir about growing up evangelical called Growing Pains, Learning to Love My Father's Faith. Randall Balmer, welcome to Studio 360.
Good to be with you.
Who are evangelicals? How do we define this group?
I usually use a fairly functional definition that consists of two or three parts, depending on my mood at the time. First of all, an evangelical is somebody who takes the Bible seriously to the point of reading it literally, all the way from Genesis and the account of creation at the beginning of the Hebrew Bible, all the way through the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament, which most evangelicals regard as a kind of blueprint for understanding the end of time. The second criterion is that an evangelical is someone who believes in the centrality of a conversion or a born-again experience, which is comes from the third chapter of St. John in the New Testament, when Nicodemus visits Jesus by night and asks how he can enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus replies that he must be born again. So this becomes a transformative moment in the lives of evangelicals. I sometimes add a third criterion, and that is an evangelical is someone who, as you suggested earlier, is obligated or feels obligated to proselytize or to evangelize others, to bring others into the fold. Although my observation over the course of, I guess, nearly 50 years of watching the evangelical subculture is that evangelicals talk about doing this a great deal more than they actually do it.
You say that there's this interesting question about whether evangelicals are really about and invested in getting their message out, proselytizing, evangelizing, getting new followers in or not. And which gets us to our subject today, which is all of this effusion of television, movies, fiction, the rest of music that is Christian in some way. Do you feel as though it's mostly preaching to the converted, literally, or are they trying to get people on the edge to come and join them?
Well, they're certainly trying to get people on the edge to come and join them and even to bring new people in. I did a chapter on Jars of Clay, which is another music group that we'll probably talk about later in this program, that is a fascinating phenomenon. And they have been able to cross over. That's the big word within the evangelical music world, is trying to cross over onto the secular charts. And Jars of Clay has been able to do that because the music is really quite good, I think. And in the course of my interview with them, I noted that a friend of mine had told me that one of their songs was actually quite popular in one of the gay clubs here in New York. And they were momentarily put off by this. They didn't exactly know how to respond. But the response, once they composed themselves, was, that's great, because that means that the gospel is being propagated in places where we wouldn't normally go. And that's the sort of ethic that I think drives a lot of this pop cultural stuff.
Is this kind of Christian pop a wholly new phenomenon? And certainly in my lifetime, as I said at the beginning, it seems like it is new. But is there historical precedent?
Well, I think there's historical precedent for finding innovative ways to communicate the gospel to the culture. And I think that's what's so striking to me about evangelicalism throughout American history. And if you go back to the Great Awakening, you had George Whitefield coming over from England. And George Whitefield had been trained in the London Theater. And so he knew how to communicate very effectively with dramatic pauses and using elocution to his advantage. Contemporaries said he could bring tears to your eyes simply by saying Mesopotamia. He was that gifted as an orator. And so in a culture that at that time had no theatrical tradition, Whitefield comes through and he's an expert orator, and he was able to communicate quite effectively to the masses, not in churches, but out in the open air and in barns or in the village green, or in one notable example on Society Hill in Philadelphia. In the 20th century, you had the great urban revivalists such as Billy Sunday and later Billy Graham, who adapts all sorts of very innovative communications technologies as a means for propagating the gospel.
Is there a fundamental difference between this stuff, this pop music or that movie, and the, you know, 2,000-year history of artists basically out of the church creating art?
No, I think that the artistic expression has always been part of the church. I think where the difference lies is that in earlier centuries of church history, the patronage tended to be from the church or even from the state or from wealthy individuals, whereas now
it's the marketplace.
It's the marketplace. The evangelicals know how to use the marketplace. And believe me, some of the things that we'll talk about today, the people who created them are making money off of it, and they know how to use the market to their own advantage and at the same time to preach the gospel.
Doing well by doing good.
That's right.
You grew up evangelical, and you wrote a book about your struggle with your faith. As a kid growing up in this strict evangelical household in Iowa, what was your consumption of culture? Did you have TV, movies?
We didn't have TV in my early childhood, although I've never been able to determine if that was because of moral objections to television or the fact that we were fairly poor. My father being, at that time, a country minister, a country parson, if you will, really did not have a whole lot of money, or at least that I was aware of. So that may have been a big part of it. But I think there was larger moral objections to television. But generally, there was a suspicion of the larger culture. There was a sense that the larger culture was alien, it was corrupt, and it was itself corrupting. I grew up within this subculture, as I call it, in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And the most damning thing that you could say about a fellow believer was that she or he was worldly. Worldliness was the worst sort of sin that you could commit, because it meant that you were not maintaining your own purity.
Well, so when we see this explosion of Christian movies and Christian novels and TV and all the music and all the rest of it, does that mark, at least for some substantial part of the population you're talking about, an end to that suspicion? Because those are worldly and they make money.
Absolutely. I think what happened, along about 1980, the evangelical subculture ceased being a counterculture. And I think it had to do with all sorts of cultural forces that were all of a sudden in play, beginning, I think, with the presidential campaign of Jimmy Carter, who talked about being a born-again evangelical Christian. Reagan signals that evangelicals have finally arrived. And along with that, the whole notion of conspicuous consumption and so forth, and evangelicals went along for the ride.
And to the degree those walls are being made permeable, and all of the you know, as I spoke about watching the Trinity Broadcasting Network and all this sort of merger with the culture at large, what does that portend for 50 years down the line? Is this kind of fiercely separate Christian culture going to lose its sense of separateness even more?
It's hard to say. That's a really good question, because I think some of that has happened already. But the real genius behind evangelicalism, besides what I mentioned earlier, the genius for communications, is the ability of evangelicals to position themselves on the margins of the culture, whether they are or not, but to think of themselves on the margins of the culture. So even with all of this pop culture that is flooding the marketplace, there's still a sense that it's not mainstream, that the world or the larger society is not fully accepting us or our ideas, and that allows the evangelicals, I think, to keep their edge.
So that's being rejected a little bit is a desirable thing.
My reading of American religious history is that the most successful religious movements in American history have positioned themselves as exclusive rather than inclusive, on the margins rather than at the center of the culture.
My guest today is the Columbia University professor Randall Balmer. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about evangelical pop culture. Coming up, we'll hear about a hugely popular book series set in a present-day apocalypse. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is supported in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the best of Caetano Veloso, a collection of 15 songs by the Grammy-winning Brazilian singer and songwriter, available at Tower Records and tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the author and professor of religion, Randall Balmer. We're talking about popular culture created by and to a significant degree for evangelical Christians. You may not know the name of Jerry Jenkins, but his books are huge bestsellers on the order of John Grisham and Stephen King. Jenkins is the co-author of the Christian fiction series Left Behind. The 11-volume series of novels is becoming the cornerstone of a whole media industry. We asked Amy Reinhart to take a look.
The last book of the Bible is Revelation, which is the only book of the New Testament written as a prophecy. Revelation describes great battles between good and evil at the end of the world. It also describes a period where God seems to take all the Christians to heaven and leaves the rest of the world in turmoil.
Missing? What do you mean missing?
A whole bunch of people are just gone.
Hattie, this is a big plan.
This is the opening of the audio drama version of Jerry Jenkins' Left Behind. The book series sets Revelation in the present. It asks, what would happen if the end times began today?
Shoes, socks, clothes, everything left behind. The people are gone. Please.
Jenkins and his co-author, Tim LaHaye, follow four characters who don't start out as Christians. Here Jenkins reads from the first book, where Rayford Steele talks about his wife's faith before the Christian's mysterious disappearance into heaven.
Rayford's greatest fear was that this religious fixation would not fade like Irene's Amway days, her Tupperware phase, and her aerobics spell. He could just see her ringing doorbells and asking if she could read people a verse or two. Surely she knew better than to dream of his tagging along. Irene had become a full-fledged religious fanatic, and somehow that freed Rayford to daydream without guilt about Hattie Durham.
When Rayford and the others realize they've been left behind by God, they convert to Christianity, and they form a tribulation force to battle enemies of God and convert other people to Jesus, hoping to save as many people as they can before God's final judgment. The series' hook is fear, the fear of being turned away by God for eternity. But that doesn't mean the books aren't playful or lively. Jenkins places characters in everyday situations with everyday temptations. Notice how Rayford Steele considers infidelity.
Why, Captain Steele. What's the matter? Irene spending a little bit too much time at church?
The books have an Antichrist antagonist as well, Nikolai Carpathia. Carpathia is Russian, runs the United Nations, owns the Chicago Tribune, and he's Satan.
You look as though you've just seen the devil himself. Are you all right?
My feeling is when I read, as I say, the competition, when I read John Irving or Stephen King or John Grisham, I think all writers have a message, and most of them don't apologize for it or deny it. And, you know, as a Christian novelist, I have a message too, a worldview, and people will talk about how, you know, isn't this just a way to get your message across? And I say, yes, it is.
Even if you're a reader of Left Behind, its popularity might be bigger than you realize. The series has sold nearly 60 million books, which is on par with John Grisham. And this number doesn't even include sales from Christian bookstores, sales from places like the Anchor Room.
You found everything that you need? All right.
The Anchor Room is a Christian bookstore in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It started in Pauline and Paul Hossopple's basement and has grown to a 20,000 square foot retail operation.
This was a gradual thing. I think that I mean, all along the way, we just felt the Lord leading us one step at a time. And never in our wildest imagination did we ever think we would have a store like this. I mean, we want it to be a ministry in our community, and that's our goal. The Lord is giving us this space to build this building because it's a busy place, and we believe that this is where we should be.
The Anchor Room looks like a Barnes & Noble or Borders, except this store carries candies with Bible verse wrappers, Christian music, fiction, paintings, and bumper stickers with messages like Boycott Hell. Gordon Miller is the Hossopple's son-in-law and manager of the Anchor Room.
We're hoping to obviously reach people who are already Christian and give them resources that are going to help them down what I would call their life path, you know, help them as they journey closer to Christ. One of our goals of the Anchor Room is to be what we would call a third place. You know, everybody has work and they have home. And then everybody kind of wants to have a third place to go to hang out, to feel like, oh man, it's some place I just want to be at.
The Anchor Room, like Christian publishing in general, is no longer stuck in the basement. The writing and distribution are now good enough to compete with mass market fiction. And sometimes, like Jerry Jenkins has, they beat the competition.
A lot of people in the Christian market are saying, you know, we've surrendered the arts to the general market for so long, we're not even competing there, we're not taken seriously. And when we do try to compete, sometimes it's so vapid and awful that they say, you know, here's the reason you don't compete. It's not because of your message, it's because of your quality. And so our hope is that, you know, when we put out our first movie a couple of years ago, my whole goal there was to say, I want to avoid the cringe factor. I want people to watch this movie and not say, well, for a Christian movie or for a movie made by a Christian, it's not bad.
With millions of books sold and an ambitious film production company, Jerry Jenkins is a media mogul. He knows that for his message to get out, the movies and books have to sell themselves beyond their built-in audience.
My goal is to persuade, and I realize I'm not going to persuade everybody, and yet I want them to see the message, and also I want the fiction to work you know, just elementally, because if it doesn't, then they'll just say, oh, this isn't really an entertaining novel, it's just a sermon disguised as fiction.
For Studio 360, I'm Amy Reinhart.
To find out more about the Left Behind series, visit our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson with Randall Balmer, the writer and scholar of Christian culture. Randall, have you read any of the Left Behind books?
I've read parts of several of them, yes. I don't think that I've read one cover to cover, to be honest.
And what do you think of them?
Well, it's as a historian, I have to put it in kind of a historical context. And I think the immediate context is a kind of fascination, even a fixation on the part of many evangelicals with the book of Revelation, with understanding or trying to understand what is going to happen at the end of time. I guess to step back even further, I would have to say that, or point out at least, that such people as Martin Luther did not believe that the book of Revelation belonged in the canon of Scripture.
That we should be clear about that. It has had a controversial history about whether it belongs in the Bible or not.
Yes, it certainly has, and that goes back through the centuries. So I guess for that reason, I view with some suspicion the amount of time that many evangelicals spend on the book of Revelation.
The writer, novelist C.S. Lewis, who wrote Chronicles of Narnia, among many other books, wasn't, I guess, an evangelical, or we wouldn't have called him that. But his books about faith are widely used by Christians.
Sure.
Is that a correct use of those books, in your view?
Oh, I think so. I mean, Lewis was certainly a Christian, and he certainly was trying to propagate the faith in the media that were available to him as a writer and a very good writer. And again, when I was growing up within this evangelical subculture, C.S. Lewis was kind of taken as a paradigm for how someone should engage the culture, how someone should, a person of faith, like a Christian, should try to propagate the faith to others. And so he was, and of course, you know, going to one of these Christian colleges, the intellectual sophistication that C.S. Lewis brought to his craft was something that we tried to emulate.
Well, as Jerry Jenkins was saying in that piece, attempting to, you know, achieve a level of craft rather than just putting forth his message.
I think so, yeah. That's the you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that it doesn't aspire to the level of art. And on the other hand, I think more and more of these evangelical Christians are trying to do that, take that quite seriously.
It seems to me that the Bible is all about great stories. Does that naturally lend itself to kind of narrative explorations of C.S. Lewis kind or Jerry Jenkins kind?
That's a really good question, because my sense of the evangelical subculture, again, from growing up within it in the latter half of the 20th century, was that the whole notion that the Bible was inerrant, that is, without error, was so prevalent as a doctrine that kind of overshadowed the entire Bible, that the literary merits of the Bible tended to be lost. And I think that it led to a kind of, at least for me, I'll speak only for myself, but I suspect for others as well, but it led to a kind of mechanistic reading of the Scriptures that robbed them of their vitality. As an extension of that, I was always suspicious of fiction, generally, because it wasn't true. It wasn't real in the way that the Bible was true and the Bible was real. Now I think, as I hope, a more mature believer, I've come to appreciate the texture and the narrative of the Scriptures, the stories they tell, particularly in the Gospels. And I view the Gospels themselves as an invitation for me as a believer to weave my own narrative in with that of the Gospels.
It's interesting when you say that the Bible was looked at in this mechanistic, nonfiction, ultimate nonfiction way. It reminds me a little bit of how often in unfortunate cases in schools, great works of literature are reduced to their themes and their bits of homework, and kids end up not liking, thinking they don't like fiction because
sure,
it's just it is the art of it, the beauty of it, is sort of kept from them.
I think that's right.
Randall, we're going to turn to something I know you've explored in one of your books, contemporary Christian music. We're going to hear from two bands. First, the Danielson Family, a group from New Jersey that has Christian as well as non-Christian fans. The band plays rock clubs along the East Coast, including hipster spaces like the Knitting Factory in Manhattan. They say they want their shows to express faith and create spectacle. The Danielson Family is a real family, but their name is actually Smith, and Daniel Smith is the leader.
The Danielson Family is myself and four brothers and sisters, a friend from kindergarten, and my wife and his wife, and that's the core group. Musically, it comes out of who we are. My brothers each play drum kits, and that's what they did in grade school. They were marching band drum captains, so therefore they play the drums, and my sister, Megan, she plays glockenspiel, and Rachel plays flute, and I play acoustic guitar, and Chris plays keyboards, and all of us sing together as well. And it's just this organic thing that came very naturally. Our live performance is made up of the men wearing doctor's scrubs and the women wearing vintage nurse outfits. And we have hearts on our sleeves and our name on our chest. We incorporate Motown-style hand moves to go along with the songs. You know, we try to incorporate sing-along as much as possible, as much as I can pressure everyone in the audience to do so. I think it tends to be pretty aggressive. I know I'm coming to terms with the fact that I like to rock, and I think the family does. I can say yes, I can say oh no. Sometimes two sinners come one and all. We live every day as our last, not bound by what we see and is blessed from the past. We have work, good and bad. We're gonna sing the wide and long and high and deep, oh Lord. You're the voice from where we belong. We just try to roll with what the Spirit's doing. The Lord is there and working, and he's making truth available. He's making healing available. He's bringing joy. He's bringing peace. And if people will roll with it and hang in there and not leave and join in with the fun, there are deeper mysteries that take place. And I don't know what they are. I just believe it, and I've seen the fruits of that many times. And joy is certainly one of the key fruits that people go home with.
Daniel Smith of the band The Danielson Family. Michael Raphael produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson with the religion scholar Randall Balmer, and we are talking about all kinds of Christian pop. What an amazing thing that is, that the Danielsons seem to me to be, because there's clearly this kind of avant-gardist affect and approach, but apparently a sincerely Christian message. What do you make of it?
It appears to me, this is the first time, my first time, I'm afraid, so I don't exactly know what to say about this. But yeah, I think I would probably revert to my original or general observation that this is be another example of the ingenious ways in which an evangelical Christian tries to package the gospel. I don't mean package necessarily in a pejorative sense, but to translate the gospel into the idiom of the culture.
And all of the little nooks and crannies of the idiom of the culture.
Absolutely. It's quite remarkable.
The next music we'll hear about is called Gospel Go-Go. Not go-go as in dancers in cages and white boots circa our childhood in 1965, or at least mine, since I guess you weren't allowed to watch that stuff. We're talking about go-go music, which is Washington, D.C.'s homegrown form of hip-hop that began 30 years ago. In the 90s, some D.C. bands started mixing Christian messages into their go-go songs, as Jackie Gales Webb reports.
Go-go is dance music. It was born in the early 70s in the clubs and streets of Washington, D.C. Hits like I Feel Like Bustin' Loose and Doing the Butt made the charts, but go-go is at its best live.
Oh my goodness!
The sexual gyrations of the dancers, the call and response with the crowd, the heavy, funky drum beat. Unfortunately, the crime that sometimes accompanies the go-go club scene cast a shadow on the music. Submission, a band formed in 1995, hopes to change that image. Shannon Moore is the group's president. He's known as Worm.
We're different in the fact that we're praising God. And that's our main difference. For believers who come in, we want to set up an atmosphere of praise and worship. For those who are non-believers that come in, we want to first portray a message of the gospel to them, and as well to show them that Christian people are not stuck up and they're not tight in the behind, and we can have fun in the Lord.
Submission is not the first band to play gospel go-go, but lead singer Jason Jones praised that a newly released CD will put them on the map.
We kind of wait for the day that we can all, you know, kind of quit our day jobs and be full-time, you know, ministers of music. And I really trust and believe that that's something God will do in this timing.
Hey, young brothers, it's time to put down the guns. Young brothers, it's time to obey your parents at home.
But we just feel like with the gospel message, you know, with the message of Christ, that it just allows us into places that go-go wouldn't normally go.
Band member Andrew Wilson says that the music inspires the crowds to do the latest dance craze called Beat Your Feet. The dancers contort their arms and legs like the boneless scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz.
Beat Your Feet is, I want to say, it's more of a freestyle type of dance. I would say breakdancing is about the closest thing I've seen to Beat Your Feet.
But breakdancing for the Lord, will that go over in the churches?
Some people may shrug their face or, you know, tighten up or ask not for us not to do that. But I say if you're praising God, you're praising God.
Well, come on, we praise harder, we praise harder, we praise harder, we praise harder, we praise harder.
You see people in church and you see the old ladies and men, they're shouting and they're running all over the church. And you can't say that's not of God. So I don't see why expression of how you feel would be anything not of God.
For Studio 360, I'm Jackie Gales Webb.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the religion scholar Randall Balmer, and we're talking about evangelical pop. Coming up, we'll talk more about gospel go-go and hear from a painter who wants to put a little metaphor back into his tradition. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Well, it can happen in the morning, afternoon, or night. Jesus Christ is coming back like a thief in the night. Are you ready? Cause this world won't be no more. When he returns, no one can save you from the wrath of the Lord.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson with the Columbia University professor and cultural critic Randall Balmer. And we're talking about Christian pop.
Teaching the world to praise the Lord is the name of our game. All aboard, everybody come ride on a train.
Randall, the go-go music that we just heard is interesting in a very different way than the other band we listened to earlier, the Danielson Family. For one reason, because it sounds as though by its energetic nature, it tends to go toward the sexual, as opposed to listening to the Danielsons, which I don't think would make anybody want to boogie very much. And I wonder how, you know, Christians would feel about, you know, music in which part of the expression is this sexualized dance.
Well, all I can say is we've come a long way from the 1950s when I had to take a note from my parents to be excused from square dance class in gym because that was regarded as a violation of my behavioral code as a believer. I think the way to explain this, and the only way I can think to explain this, is the influence of Pentecostalism within evangelical Christianity.
Now, what does that mean?
Pentecostalism is a movement that really began at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was marked by a great deal of enthusiasm and excitation, people raising their hands in the air. And this is...
Not just in the black churches.
Not just in the black churches, but also in the white churches. Pentecostal denominations such as the Assemblies of God, for example, would be part of this, but many others as well. And this sort of free expression, which is, you're quite right, quite sexual in many ways, or at least it has those sorts of undertones, the kind of simmering just beneath the surface. That sort of expression has, over the course of the 20th century and now into the 21st century, really pervaded much of the evangelical subculture. You see it primarily in changes in worship styles on Sunday morning in almost every evangelical church that I've been to over the last 20, 30 years.
Meaning more emotive and less uptight and Episcopalian?
Right.
Nothing against Episcopalians?
Right, exactly. There's nothing Episcopalian about this at all. It's quite free and meant to be meditative. It's almost disassociational. That is, one is
non-rational.
Absolutely, very, very. There's a good way to put it. It's builds on the affections and the emotions, and this sort of physical expression now is the next step that we've just heard about with this remarkable group from Washington D.C. And I think that's in some ways the new frontier.
It's especially interesting to hear an African-American idiom adopt this explicitly Christian
yes.
message, given that, of course, from the Pentecostal roots comes gospel, comes then
Absolutely.
Rock and roll and R&B and all the rest. It's as though it's this thing that began as religion became pop culture, now is becoming religious again.
I think that's right. I think there's a lot of that has to be taken into account, yes.
My guest today is the Columbia University religion professor, Randall Balmer. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we've been talking about Christian pop, but our last story is about something in a more high art tradition. There are hundreds of great paintings created by artists devoted to Jesus Christ. Works by Giotto and Michelangelo were part of a tradition inspired by Roman Catholicism. But after the Reformation, lots of Protestants were happy to let the visual tradition wither. Trey Kay spoke to a contemporary Christian artist who's trying to help evangelicals embrace pictures again.
20 years ago, Bruce Herman was starting a new teaching job at Gordon College, a Christian school in Wenham, Massachusetts. At the time, he had been a painter for about a decade, but was quite new to life as an evangelical. The dean asked him to give a lecture to the faculty explaining his artistic development and his life as a Christian. After the lecture, Herman took a few questions.
And so the first question was from the left-hand side of the auditorium. Mr. Herman, can you tell us why, in your opinion, no great visual artist has come out of the evangelical fold? And as I was trying to think of a convincing answer, another hand shot up on the opposite side of the auditorium, and a man said, I think I can answer that question. The imagination doesn't grow in this soil. Perhaps what he meant is that evangelical Christians by and large, or many anyway, are uncomfortable with ambiguity, mystery, and also that those are the qualities that adhere to the cutting edge of art, that you know, poets and painters and composers are always playing around in that. They swim in those waters that many evangelical Christians might not want to get their feet into.
The fact is, since the Reformation, Protestants generally, and evangelicals specifically, have been wary of using sacred images. Herman says that the objection had less to do with the Second Commandment against drawing pictures of God, and more to do with the Roman Catholics' extensive use of sacred images. He says that some art historians equate the Church's use of religious art in the 16th century to a modern-day Madison Avenue campaign.
It seemed, you know, overblown and hyped up, and that all those heavy decorations inside of those big Catholic churches seemed to need to be stripped away to get at the pure thing. So there's this kind of purification process going on among the reformers, trying to get down to what is really bedrock Christianity. And for them, that was the Word of God, that was the Bible, and not imagery. Because imagery seems to be associated with extra stuff beyond the Bible, beyond the purity.
In some ways, Herman's paintings bridge between modern art and pre-Reformation Christian art. For starters, he paints images of Christian saints onto a prepared canvas of gold and silver leaf. His bold, nude forms seem to generate heat as they appear before cold architectural structures that defy identification to place or period. Herman seems to have an emotional connection to his subjects, which convey both gritty earthiness and a divine splendor, resulting in a kind of beautiful brokenness. Herman is respected in the secular art world, but there are some who don't know what to make of his work. He also finds that sometimes his brethren evangelicals are perplexed as well.
On the one hand, among evangelical Christians, what I do as an artist is not fully embraced, although there are more and more people who are interested in what I'm doing and patronizing it. But it's still a relatively small number of people, probably. And on the other hand, you know, in the secular art establishment, I've had, you know, some rejection, not simply because of the quality of the work, because I've been told the work is of a very high quality, but because of the subject matter, the imagery, the fact that it's religious, it's meant religious imagery. It's, you know, that makes the secular art world uncomfortable. If it were ironic, it would be easier, because then no one has to own it.
But owning it is the entire point of Herman's work. By owning his faith, he says that he draws power from the biblical stories of sacrifice. He told me that his secular painting mentor, Philip Guston, envied his connection to Christianity when Guston was deeply moved by the Legend of the True Cross murals by Piero della Francesca.
Guston looked up and pointed up to the murals. He said, "These Christians, they had a story. We don't have a story." And what he was talking about was, you know, late 20th century artists and intellectuals, they don't have that juice that sort of drives people to make great, great art or great music or great poetry. And then he turned it around when he was telling us this story. He said, "So, be like the early Christians and go underground. Paint from your heart and don't give a rip about what anyone says."
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
You can see images of paintings by Bruce Herman at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson with the Columbia University professor Randall Balmer, and we're talking about evangelical Christian art and entertainment. It is very interesting what Bruce Herman was saying, I think, and you were nodding, so I assume it's true, or you think it's true-ish, about the degree to which evangelicals, serious Christians, are not drawn to ambiguity as an interesting place to have their minds.
I think that's right. I found that segment quite compelling.
And I think that segment actually provides a very eloquent critique to the phenomenon we were talking about earlier, particularly as regards to the book of Revelation, and wanting to evangelicals wanting to figure it all out. Well, when is this going to occur? When is that going to occur? Rather than simply immersing themselves in all this florid imagery and trying to live with the ambiguity that arises from the fact that we're never going to be able to figure out what all this means, and maybe we're not supposed to spend all that much time worrying about it. But I think that what we're talking about here is the difference between abstract and representational art. And representational art, as applied to the Bible or approaches to the Bible, is a kind of slavishly literalistic approach to the scriptures, whereas abstract art, or non-representational art at least, allows, as the artist said so well, ambiguity to flourish and to kind of revel in the liminal space of that approach.
It strikes me that there's something American about this particular, I won't call it a problem, but issue. I mean, that it's the American person and the American character has always been practical and kind of sensibly literal, and carried into the spiritual realm, it means that, you know, abstract art or Mark Rothko paintings or whatever, all of art that is, as you say, liminal or mysterious or hard to get your head around easily, is seen as a sort of an assault or not what one wants to embrace.
I think that's right. We Americans are, if nothing, pragmatic and you know, kind of no-nonsense approach to life. And the same as I think guided our approach to the Bible, especially among evangelicals.
Now, we've talked about all this explicitly Christian popular culture and art. It strikes me that these big epic films of this moment, like Lord of the Rings and the Matrix trilogy, are so almost explicitly, but certainly implicitly, religious and Christian in many of their gestures and stories. Do you think, as I do, that they play on the yearnings in many people, Christians and more especially not Christians, for those large narratives that explain existence?
I think so. I think we Americans are incurably religious in many ways. If you look at our religious behavior, or at least our stated religious behavior and beliefs, we're off the charts compared to other Western countries. At the same time, I think religion at the beginning of the 21st century is a dirty word. Spirituality is all the rage. And spirituality, of course, can be anything at all. I like to talk about someone who considers herself a Presbyterian, who wakes up in the morning, reads her horoscope, does Tai Chi in Central Park, wears a crystal around her neck, and does yoga when she gets home from work, and considers all of this to be perfectly consistent with her status as a Presbyterian or Catholic, whatever it may be. Now, this is a fictional caricature.
But barely. Not really.
Well, I think that's
right. We know those people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of a...
I'm married to one of those
people.
Okay,
well, there you go. I think there is a sense in which we Americans like to pick and choose, and we are very eclectic in our spiritual tastes. And this is reflected, I think, in the popular culture of a non-evangelical character as well.
Why is there this tremendous explosion of stuff right now? Sitting right in front of us, for instance, which we haven't mentioned, is this magazine called Revolve that looks for all the world like Teen People or Marie Claire or some young women's magazine. It is the New Testament published simply in magazine form with cute sidebars and, you know, pictures of cute boys and girls. Why now?
I think there's a hunger within the culture. We talked about it a minute ago, this quest for spirituality. And evangelical Christians want to be part of that that marketplace so that they can peddle their wares on that marketplace. And again, I don't mean that pejoratively necessarily, although I think some of the market mentality tends to get carried away. And this is the first time I've seen it, but this I've heard about this this publication, and it tries to, again, speak the idiom of the culture. I worry somewhat about this phenomenon from the inside, from evangelicalism itself. I think this kind of unremitting commerce with the culture probably does corrupt at some level. In a sense, my father was right from the 1950s and 1960s. We do have to maintain something of a countercultural stance. I don't see much criticism. I don't see much evidence of a counterculture in evangelicalism today, in politics, in the culture itself. I don't see many evangelical social critics who are thoughtful and articulate and willing to put their fingers on the real transgressions in the culture.
And in their own subculture.
Absolutely.
Randall Balmer, thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
My pleasure, Kurt.
Randall Balmer is a professor of religion at Columbia University and the author of Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory and Growing Pains. You can find out more about him and any of the stories you heard today at studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Sarah Lilly,
Andy Lanza,
Trent Wolby,
Adam Allington,
Megan Metcalf,
John H. Stanek III.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, accelerating entrepreneurship across America. On the web at kauffman.org. Additional support provided by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the best of Caetano Veloso, a collection of 15 songs by the Grammy-winning Brazilian singer and songwriter, available at Tower Records and tower.com/nonesuch.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
And we are upside down and then right side back on. Oh.
A woman recreates her father's last skydive in a music video.
It felt to me that he might have chosen to die. That feeling of flying and never coming down, in essence.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Up in the air next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.